Every Christian is familiar with the radical and sometimes scandalous teachings of Jesus when he said, "Love your enemies and bless the ones cursing you." I just hold that thought. We recall that the hope and prayer of Jesus was that the will of God be done on earth as it is in heaven. His ministry emphasized the passionate belief that this world and this life could be, and indeed should be, energized, blessed, and enriched by filling it with divine, we'll call it heavenly, attributes that would make this life more peaceful, more fulfilling, and more abundant. In light of that, we view his challenge to love your enemies as divine love in action, because according to the Apostle Paul, this is exactly what our God in heaven did for us. Before our change, our conversion, we, says Paul, were hostile towards God. We were in defiance of his will for our lives, and we were in opposition naturally to following the laws that were intended to guide us. So, if we have received divine love while we were still in conflict with God, then it is reasonable for him, through the words of Jesus, to ask us to be willing to love our enemies and those who offend and hurt us. There's an incident in the life of Israel's King David that beautifully illustrates the risk and scandal of loving an enemy. At the end of the book of 1 Samuel, Israel's first king, Saul, has lost God's favor, and his life comes to a tragic end. I'm reading from the New Living Translation from 1 Samuel 31, verses 1 to 6. Now the Philistines attacked Israel, and the men of Israel fled before them. Many were slaughtered on the slopes of Mount Gilboa. The Philistines closed in on Saul, and they killed three of his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew very fierce around Saul, and the Philistine archers caught up with him and wounded him severely. Saul groaned to his armor-bearer, "Take your sword and kill me before these pagan Philistines come to run me through and taunt and torture me." But his armor-bearer was afraid and refused to do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When his armor-bearer realized that Saul was dead, he too fell on his own sword and died beside the king. So Saul, his three sons, his armor-bearer, and his troops all died together in the field of battle that day. Now, in ancient societies, it was very dangerous to trust any relative of your dead enemy. David had loved Saul, and especially his son Jonathan. But due to jealousy and resentment, Saul had grown to hate David and had hunted him like a rabid animal. But now Saul and all three of his sons are dead. The enemy is removed, right? David can ascend to the throne of Israel in peace, right? Well, Saul and his sons were killed, but Saul had grandsons. In 2 Samuel 4, verse 4, Saul's son Jonathan had a son named Mephibosheth, who was crippled as a child. He was 5 years old when the report came from Jezreel that Saul and Jonathan had been killed in battle. And when the child's nurse heard the news, she picked him up and fled, obviously worried that he would be a target. But as she hurried away, she dropped him, and he became crippled. Mephibosheth was a serious threat to David. Even in his crippled state, he could still make a serious claim at some point in the future that he should succeed his grandfather as king, since he was a direct descendant. In normal circumstances, it would have been prudent for David to kill off any surviving family members of Saul. But Mephibosheth was the son of his best friend, Jonathan. And David had compassion on the boy, even though he was still technically an enemy. After Saul's death, David is anointed king of all Israel. And it's a glorious reign. He restores the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, and God makes a new promise to David that his descendants would rule Israel from that time forward for all time. But in real political terms, Mephibosheth remains a serious threat, always lurking in the background. We're told that David goes on a killing spree to eradicate or subjugate all enemies of Israel, including the Philistines, the Arameans, the Moabites, and Edomites. And we pick up the story in 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1. It says, "One day David asked one of Saul's servants named Ziba, 'Is anyone still alive from Saul's family? If so, I want to kill them all.'" No, he doesn't say that. He says, "If anyone is still alive from Saul's family, I want to show God's kindness to them." Ziba replied, "Yes, only one. One of Jonathan's sons is still alive. He's crippled in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asked. "In Lo Debar," Ziba told him, "at the home of Machir, son of Amiel." So David sent for him and brought him from Machir's home. And when he came to David, he bowed low to the ground in deep respect. And David says, "Greetings, Mephibosheth." And Mephibosheth replied, "I am your servant." Now at this point, Mephibosheth would likely have been expected to be summoned to his execution or banishment. He would have been trembling with fear. "Don't be afraid," David said. "I intend to show kindness to you because of my promise to your father, Jonathan. I will give you all the property that once belonged to your grandfather, Saul, and you will eat here with me at the king's table." Mephibosheth bowed respectfully and exclaimed, "Who is your servant that you should show such kindness to a dead dog like me?" Incredible sense of fear, an incredible sense that his life was worthless. He expected to die that day. Then the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and servants are to farm the land for him to produce food for your master's household, but Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, will be like a son to me and eat at my table." And Ziba replied, "Yes, my lord the king, I am your servant. I will do all that you have commanded." And from that time on, Mephibosheth ate regularly at David's table like one of the king's own son. One of the most difficult things about preparing for this sermon was hoping that I could pronounce Mephibosheth over and over again. You try it. Mephibosheth, especially since it wasn't actually his name. Mephibosheth was a name given to the boy when the story was written, but it means from the mouth of shame. And that is a reference to him being the direct relative of his grandfather Saul and all the shameful things that Saul had said and done against David. His actual name was Memphibal, or as it's recorded in the book of Chronicles, Meribaal. But you might recognize the last part of that name is Baal, B-A-A-L, which is the name of a Canaanite god. So they didn't want to use that name. It didn't mean that in his case, but they changed it to Mephibosheth so it would leave a lasting story about David's love for this enemy. Mephibosheth stands as a testament of David's capacity to love his enemy, and it became a symbol for the Christian church of God's unyielding love for us, his enemies. He made peace with everything in heaven and on earth by means of Christ's blood on the cross. This, says Paul, includes you, the Colossian readers, you and everyone else who were once far away from God, either because they were Gentiles and not the Jewish people, children of Israel, or simply because they didn't know God. He says you were all his enemies, and as such, separated from him by your evil thoughts and actions. Yet now he has reconciled you to himself through the death of Christ in his physical body. And as a result, he has brought you, his enemies, into his own presence. You might say into his temple, into his palace, into his dining room. And you are now considered holy and blameless as you stand before him without a single fault. So then we are no longer enemies of God. He has made us to be like sons and daughters, to eat at his banquet table, to live in his presence. But that's not the end of the matter. This is not just a gift to us. It is a model of a gift that we must give to others over and over and over again. We are now required to have an ongoing hunger for reconciliation, an endless desire, a longing to live in harmony with others, and a quickness to forgive the offenses of others. It is the gift of grace that we must show to our enemies, and it's only possible when we see those enemies for more than their offenses to us and more than our hope for revenge or even justice. I want to revisit quickly the motivation for why one day David seems to suddenly, out of the blue, ask his servants, "Is anyone still alive from Saul's family? If so, I want to show God's kindness to them." I'm sure you can imagine that wouldn't have been just a sudden off-the-cuff thought that David had. I'm sure he thought about this for weeks, months, possibly years. I think the answer comes down to three things. David's friendship with Mephibosheth's father, Jonathan, was real and powerful and deep and continued after his death. Secondly, David clearly had a high level of emotional intelligence. In this case, he could recall the brutality, the egomania of Saul. He could still feel the fear of losing his own life to that madman. But an emotionally intelligent person can rationalize that evil that he was capable of was and is not the complete picture. David was well aware that Mephibosheth was a serious potential threat, an enemy that he was bringing into his own palace to eat at his own table as a family member. But the risk was a reasonable one, and the benefits far outweighed the risks. And it's a dynamic illustration of the maxim that love is more powerful than fear and hostility and anger. And thirdly, David believed with all his might that he was the recipient of God's generous and unwarranted love and support. And thus he was obliged to demonstrate a similar love to those who didn't deserve it. Many of the Psalms talk about David's gratitude to God for caring for him, for saving his life, for providing for him. In Psalm 116, for example, verses 1 to 2, David says, "I love the Lord, for he heard my voice when I cried out. He heard my cry for mercy. Because he turned his ear to me, I will call on him as long as I live." That connection obligated David to also listen to the cries of others and those who wanted mercy from him. Let's close by reminding ourselves about one of the most fundamental, the most difficult and unique teachings of Jesus. Back to Matthew 5:43-48. Jesus is speaking either on the mountain or at the foot of the mountain to a crowd of people gathering. This was during his early ministry, right at the beginning, when crowds of hundreds, possibly thousands, came to listen to him. These crowds were the reason the Pharisees hated him. He was popular. They preferred listening to him than they did to the other rabbis. And Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, 'Love your neighbor and hate your enemy.'" Well, that's just normal human practice. No one needs to tell you to love your friendly neighbor and to hate your enemy. "But I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. And in so doing, you will be acting and behaving and thinking as children of your Father in heaven." It's his characteristic. "Your Father in heaven causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good." Fair enough. "He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." Obviously, you can't selectively have the sun rise just for the good people and the rain fall on their crops and not on the enemy's crops. "If you love those who love you," says Jesus, "what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that?" And of course, the tax collectors represented the most corrupt, the most despised traitors of Israel. "And if you greet only your own people, the people who are like you, of your race and your culture and your neighborhood, your type of people that like to do the things you like, that share the same interests, if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others?" So even in our practice, Paul's very much a spiritualist when it comes to defining what a Christian is. Jesus tends to be very practical. You should be different than other people. You shouldn't live the same way. You shouldn't behave the same way. You shouldn't have the same values. Otherwise, how are you any different? Do not even the pagans do that? There should be something about Christians that is different. And this, says Jesus, is the heart and core of how to know that you are not just the same as the pagans. And then he closes with, "Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." And I'm sure the audience hearing that, it would have blown them away. Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect? I should be the same as God? He's not saying that. Divine perfection is an impossibly high calling. And of course, we will fail in all aspects of this, including, and I can say from personal experience, including failing to always love your enemies all the time and those that despise you. I've enjoyed a few thoughts of revenge at times, of justice, of "I'm going to get you someday." So no, I haven't lived this perfectly. I don't live this perfectly today. But that's not the point of what Jesus taught. And I'll leave you with this thought. This statement, this teaching, this Sermon on the Mount is aspirational. It's what we must aim for. It's what we must agree with, first of all. The bar is set at the top, and any effort and any success that we might have in closing the gap between our normal carnal response to our enemies and the calling to divine perfection will make our life of greater value and our time on earth more enriching for others as well as ourselves.